On this week's 51%, hear the story of a woman reconciling with her past and working toward equitable and just relationships.
The intertwining of race and rape have been defining my brown body long before it emerged from my white mother's womb.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Artist and producer Ari Golden brings us another installment of her Bending in 2020 series, this time an audio portrait of a woman embracing her trauma and emerging stronger. The story explores the themes of resilience, healing, and transformational change. Please be advised that, though not graphic, there is discussion of rape.
My child's name is Ezel Ayodele Taylor, and Ezel is Turkish, and I've recently been informed by a Turkish friend that I'm not pronouncing it the way they would in Turkey, but it's named after my godson, and he pronounces it Ezel, so we're going with that. And Ezel in Turkish means free from the past. And Ayodele is their middle name, and that's a Yoruba name that means return to happiness. And then Taylor is my family name. When I first heard the meaning of the name Ezel, it was an awkward one. I'm like, free from the past? Is that cutting off your roots? I had some trouble relating to it, and I really did want to name Ezel after this amazing person in my life. And as I was sharing it with people, everybody, you know, from like my acupuncturist to friends, they were like, oh, that's so right. Knowing all the work I have done to free myself from the burdens of the past. So that's what I hear in it, freeing myself from the burdens and the limitations of the past. And it's worth noting that the father who is... we would call him Patata. We did in virtual fertilization, and he's a dear friend, brother of mine. He was the one who decided that this was the name sequence that we would have with Ezel and Ayodele, free from the past, return to happiness. It was really important that there be movement in the name. So moving away from the past, but returning back. The name feels whole. There's a lot of dysfunction in my own family. And it falls along the lines of race. There's also been a strong history on my father's maternal side of the family of rape. My dad's family is very light-skinned Black folk who, it is obvious, has had countless generations of slave rape. So at one point I wrote in a journal, the intertwining of race and rape have been defining my brown body long before it emerged from my white mother's womb. That was the story I was telling about my own healing journey as I was trying to create a narrative of it for myself. And that feels like those are, in a lot of ways, the themes that I want to free Ezel from. I was in a sweat lodge, actually, with my Native American community, and it was one of the early stages of the prayer preparations for bringing Ezel into the world. And they poured a sweat lodge for those of us of the Black hoop, so those of us of African descent. And it was literally a couple days before I was supposed to have fibroids removed from my uterus. And I sat in the lodge, and I was asking the ancestors, the stones, why me? Why is this happening to me? Why do I have these growths in me? And not from a place of like, why? But more of a place like, give me meaning, give me purpose with this. And very clearly what came through in that ceremony was all my ancestors that had been slave raped, and they had very specifically asked, you know, they said, you were raped because we were raped. and you are being invited to heal this wound. And if you don't, it will get passed on to future generations until it's healed. And we were unable to heal it because we literally had to get up the next day and work for the man who raped us. And we had to raise the children of those rapes as our own. And so we never had the room, the freedom, the opportunity, the privilege to mourn, to be angry. It would have cost us our lives, possibly cost our children their lives. You know, so many of the implications of being disobedient under slavery were what they were contending with. And I don't live in those times. So there was room for me to emote and feel and do the various levels and layers of work needed for me to have that be part of who I am. I'm very clear. Both the women that were raped and those that raped them are my ancestors. They're both my relatives. And to make, I don't know if peace is the right word, but to be in relationship to that in a good and healthy way, that's representative of some of the other, many other dynamics of race and gender. If my child decides or feels that the body they are in does not necessarily represent the gender that they want to be known as, then let them define the gender they want to be known as. And I've really enjoyed the conversation that it sparks, because as you walk around with the baby, everyone's like, oh, your baby's so beautiful. Is it a boy or a girl? And that invites me to invite them to recognize, A, why does that actually matter? So my answer is often, you know, we're not putting a gender on my child. We're going to let them decide that for themselves, because boys and girls get treated differently. People think boys are strong and girls are sweet. Well, my child is sweet and strong. So I don't want them to be limited to either of those projections. So we're not telling you, and we'll let you guess. So that's part of it. But it also very much relates to this moment around race in our society. And when invited to say a little bit more, I can't help but point out the fact that Black and brown people walking around, there are assumptions made about them based on the color of their skin, or if they wear a hoodie, or their pants are sagging, or sometimes you don't even need any of that, just based on the color of their skin. And those projections can and far too frequently result in those children being killed by the police, among other people, among other oppressions that happen to them. You think you know who this person is based on what they look like. And that's a pattern we need to interrupt. And part of the reason I am interrupting people in going into the habitual pattern of gendering people and therefore making assumptions about them with a gender pronoun, I'm hoping that it's also a spark to interrupt the assumptions we make about people for so many other reasons: skin color, class, language, religion. You don't know anything about this person until you know this person. Who's the soul behind the face, the skin, the hair, the clothes? Two years before that sweat lodge, when I was first diagnosed with those fibroids, and among other things, you know, I was severely depressed. I had a lot of other health issues as well. And I was suicidal. I could not figure out how to feel it all, how to feel all the conflicting pains and fears and rage, when some part of me knew that as much as the tendency is to want to be rageful at the world outside and see myself as a victim of circumstances, these are things that happened to my people. But yes, it happened to my people, but my people did this to my people. So this is, it's inside me. It's not outside me. How do I be with what is here? How can I increase my capacity to be with the discomfort of all of these emotions, the complexity of all of these emotions? Can I be with it before I decide I need to do something to change it? I'm not sure how much there is to do, and that the B part really is the journey. In a lot of ways, the female body is not valued unless it produces children. And if you can't get pregnant, for a lot of people, the ultimate brokenness. And in a lot of ways, that's what I was contending with. I mean, my uterus was full of fibroids, and I had been to four doctors that had told me I could not have children. As I wasn't afraid of that diagnosis. I did the ceremony I needed to do to make peace with that. If that was the truth, I accept that. I'll adopt. I'll become a foster parent. But there was something about how they were saying it to me that didn't feel, it just didn't feel true. It felt like, I don't know, I just felt like I was being asked to dig deeper than accepting those solutions that they were offering. And I stopped seeing doctors for about, I think it was about 2 years, and just was doing ceremony. Various types of healing and ceremony with quite an array of healers, until we did another sweat lodge when I felt like I was plateauing and not continuing to make progress in my healing. And in that sweat lodge, the question was, what now? And literally in the next week, three people, including you, Ari, all recommended the same gynecologist to me. And when I called her, she asked the very brilliant question, which no one had asked me, which is, what's the ideal outcome that you want from this situation? And I said, I want to have a kid. And she said, okay, we can do that. You learn to be with, and then you dig deeper, and then you be with that, and then you dig deeper. Many years ago, I had two herniated discs in my back, and we couldn't find any way to relieve my pain at all. I had epidurals, I was taking codeine, like nothing short of surgery was actually getting rid of it. And that's when I started doing yoga and meditation. And at some point, something suggested to me that maybe if I could just relax enough and get familiar with this discomfort, I could stop contracting in relationship to it. And as I did that, I realized that the contraction was making it worse. And the more time I spent with the sensation, and at that time, the sensation, it was just heat. It was heat and it was radiating. But I made me think about, like, I really like really hot hot tubs and really hot bathtubs. So I'm like, so why is this so awful to me? And that just made me soften it. So I was like, oh, well, what if it's just heat? Like, maybe it's not bad. Maybe that's a story I'm adding that's not necessarily the truth, but it has more to do with my unfamiliarity with it than the fact that this is actually pain. So pain is not really in my vocabulary anymore. Because of that and how I've continued to apply that to emotional moments as well as physical moments. But I just get really curious, what does it feel like to be angry or sad or scared or confused? Not intellectually, but actually, like, take a couple of breaths, get in the skin, and where's the sensation that's telling me I'm scared? And really getting into the details of it. Is it, does it have a color? Does it have a shape? Does it have a temperature, texture, movement, and befriending that sensation. And then it can teach you. And sensations show up in our body because they want us to know something. But we live in a society where we medicate that and we make those sensations go away. And when I couldn't medicate my way out of back pain, my only other option was to get to know it and find out what it wanted me to know so I could make the adjustments so I could heal. The vast majority of us are experiencing this as a traumatic moment. And I would define traumatic as overwhelming to the system, and leaving us often with little more than the ability to survive it. But I also think with every traumatic experience, there is the invitation to build resilience. Fierce Allies is relationship-based strategy for change. So showing up with fierce resiliency, fierce humility, fierce love, fierce curiosity about how we can shift from being part of the problem into being part of the solution. Not just the solutions to our problems, but solutions to the collective dismemberment of our society. And we do a lot of work around trauma healing, both individual and collective trauma. We talk about the difference between hurt and harm. We get hurt all the time, whether people do offensive things, say offensive things, make it hard for us to survive. When Ezel was born, my best friend who was in the hospital with me at the birth, she turned to me with tears in her eyes and said, "We won." And it took me a minute to remember what she was saying, but I remember when I was trying to get pregnant with Ezel and hitting every obstacle from infertility to fibroids to not being able to find a sperm donor to like so many things. I remember saying very clearly to my closest friends, "If I don't get pregnant, I feel like the rapist won." And I know that's not a healthy thing for me to say because I'm not sure how I will ever get through that if that actually becomes my reality. But there was something about the motivation of I wanted to reclaim my body for what it was designed to do. I wanted to reclaim my uterus for what it was designed to do. And when Ezel emerged and my friend Ali said, "We won. We won. We didn't lose. The rapist didn't win. I reclaimed what I had and who I'm supposed to be and what I am capable of doing. And my biggest prayer in the world has always been to be a mother. And I wouldn't be the strong person that I am if I hadn't gone through all of those levels of healing. And Ezel wouldn't be the person that they are if I hadn't gone through all those levels of healing. So if I had it to do over again, I would do it again, including the trauma. Because it makes me who I am. And I believe it makes Ezel who they are. And Ezel is perfect. The most important work that we have to do in this lifetime is our personal work. You can't just take hurt and decide that I'm going to turn it into resilience if you don't have a capacity to feel. And you can't heal if you can't feel good and bad. If you can't feel pain, you can't feel joy if you can't feel pain. And the more pain you can feel, the more joy you can feel, and the more creativity comes through you. And so there are elevator doors that you have to work on both sides. I'm in a big conversation with a lot of their sort of colleagues. They're more than that. They're spirit walk partners. And we're in a real inquiry around, what does it mean to be a bridge? Do we really want bridges? Is that really what's needed at this time? Because, you know, we've all sort of seen ourselves as bridge builders. And there's a tendency in our culture to like want us to all be together and to be unified or to see things similar. And that there's a way that our culture wants that to happen quickly that is actually about, in a lot of ways, it's disassociating from what actually is. And we can't be on the same page if we can't actually really recognize how far apart we really, really are. And so maybe in this moment, it's not about bridging. Maybe it's about mapping. Where are you? Where am I? How far apart? Are there similarities to where you are and where I am? But it's not necessarily about bringing together and finding those like universal truths. Fierce Allies in practice. The first couple of weeks after shelter in place happened, as I was connecting with my team and we're trying to figure out what to do, and we were using various practices, literally we'd read them or do them, and it was quite a thing to be like, whoa, did we write this for now? What we do is we read these aloud at the beginning of a meeting, and after reading them aloud, we check in and everyone gets to reflect on anything that's inspired by reading these, and how do you want to apply these practices to this meeting and our larger work? So they read, recognizing that being a fierce ally steward is the most rigorous training and practice for embodying fierce allyship, readying yourself for that, loving all the obstacles and opportunities, and being consistently grateful. Being fully accountable for your choice to be involved in pioneering work that is urgently needed. Accepting and navigating the natural overwhelm and disorientation with humor, dignity, humility, power, and responsibility. Planning and preparing for unpredictability and time-sensitive needs and demands. Maintaining, enhancing, and embodying personal dignity and self-care practices. Standing in I don't know as a place of power, abundantly asking clarifying questions with dignity and humility, demanding clear articulation. Generating proposals, solutions to tensions that create win-wins, mutual accountability, and increased role autonomy. Interrupting business as usual, letting go of habits and preconceptions, and pursuing new possibilities. Midwifing ourselves, each other, and our collaborators through an intentional sequence of disorientation for new orientation. Intentional sequence of disorientation for new orientation. All of a sudden, disorientation is chosen. We intended it. And really, that's just a narrative. You know, all of these things could be negatives, or they could be opportunities for resilience and for change. Because this is actually what our work is about. It's about preparing for this kind of moment. It's about being able to find grace in disorientation and unknown. Because if you're not in disorientation and unknown, you're actually in status quo and you're not actually creating change. And if you want to create change, you need to be constantly in places where you are disoriented and unfamiliar. How you author the story. And I love to just remember people to the fact that the word author and authority have the same root. And we need to authorize ourselves to be the authors of our stories.
Ari Golden is an artist and producer. Her previous Bending in 2020 story is in 51% show number 1613. You can find more about Golden's work at arigolden.com, that's ARIGOLDEN.com, and follow her on Instagram at arigolden. While there were many events throughout the U.S. this year marking the 100th anniversary of the passage of the 19th Amendment, guaranteeing and protecting women's constitutional right to vote, there was another centennial kicking off across the pond. Oxford University recognized its 100-year anniversary of the formal admission of women in October, and then, 1 week later, women were given the right to be awarded degrees. Women students who had been denied a degree since the late 1870s began to return to the university to claim them. Now, a Woman Making History centenary campaign will run throughout this academic year with a range of events and initiatives. And the university is also announcing that Professor Brenda Stevenson has been appointed as the first Hillary Rodham Clinton Chair of Women's History at the University of Oxford and a Fellow of St. John's College. The newly created chair is intended to enhance Oxford's work in women's history by undertaking pioneering research and transforming how the subject is taught and studied at Oxford. Professor Stevenson will lead the new Women, Gender, and Queer History course within the Master's History program, head the faculty's Center for Gender, Identity, and Subjectivity, develop international academic partnerships, and develop a global public outreach program, including an annual public lecture series. Professor Stevenson will join the university in September 2021 from her current role at UCLA, where she is the Nickel Family Endowed Chair in History. She is an internationally acclaimed scholar of gender, race, slavery, family, and racial conflict. Today, Oxford awards degrees to more women than men, The university has admitted more women undergraduates than men for the last 2 years. And breaking the bonds of conformity is a specialty of the salt marsh sparrow.
This is Bird Note. Salt marsh sparrow. The name tells us everything we need to know about this bird's habitat, but it discreetly leaves unmentioned this species' biggest secret, its free love mating behavior in the tidal marshes of the East Coast. New techniques for analyzing the parentage of chicks have shown that extra pair copulations, or non-monogamous relationships in birds, are not as rare as once believed. But the salt marsh sparrow takes it to an extreme, with a breeding strategy described by scientists as featuring a bond-free relationship between males and females. Meaning that males and females copulate with multiple individuals of the opposite sex, and then they go their merry way. The female builds her nest alone, where she incubates the eggs and feeds the hatchlings. If a male approaches while she's busy, she drives him away, and he doesn't come back. Due to historic habitat loss and rising sea levels, salt marsh sparrows are at serious risk of extinction. But it's not for lack of trying on her part. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1633.